Hi, this is Bridget with Science Hour. Scientific American, April 2026. Advances. Animal behavior. Cow tools. A cow named Veronica demonstrates sophisticated tool use. In news that is sure to delight fans of a certain Gary Larson cartoon turned meme about the limitations of bovine cognition, cow tools are real. Larson's 1982 comic for his series The Far Side showed a cow standing behind a table bearing an array of oddly shaped objects. The text below the image read simply, "Cow tools." Now, a pet cow named Veronica has been documented not only wielding a tool, but doing so in a surprisingly sophisticated way. The observation adds a new species to the growing list of creatures that have been found to use external objects to achieve a goal. It also hints that society has been underestimating the minds of farm animals. The story begins more than a decade ago in the small Austrian town of Notch im Galltal, where organic farmer and baker Witgar Wiegele first saw his family's pet Swiss brown cow, Veronica, pick up sticks and use them to scratch herself. When cognitive biologist Alice M.I. Ausberg of the University of Veterinary Medicine, Vienna, watched a video recording of Veronica's behavior, it was immediately clear that this was not accidental, she said in a statement. This was a meaningful example of tool use in a species that is rarely considered from a cognitive perspective. Ausberg and her colleague Antonio J. Osuna Mascaro, a postdoctoral researcher at the same institution, visited Veronica and her human family, who welcomed the researchers with freshly baked bread and apple strudel. "Veronica is very friendly," says Osuna Mascaro, who spent that summer observing her. "She also has a close bond with Witgar," he notes. "Not only does Witgar prepare and sell bread, he also distributes it around the area. It was interesting to see Veronica watching every passing car with interest and trying to guess if the driver was Witgar. If she thought it was him, she would moo with all her might." The researchers analyzed how Veronica used one particular tool, a deck brush, to scratch herself. Observing Veronica's behavior over dozens of trials, the researchers found that she pushed the broom back and forth exclusively across the rear half of her body, including the rump, loin, udder, and belly regions that would otherwise be difficult for her to reach. She precisely manipulated the broom with her mouth, using her tongue to lift it and her teeth to secure it in place. She targeted the thick-skinned upper areas of her body with the bristled end, and the more sensitive underparts with the smooth stick end. She also scrubbed more vigorously on tougher parts of her skin, and used gentle pushes on her delicate parts. To the casual observer, using a broom to scratch an itch might not seem like an act of genius, but the way Veronica changed her grip on the broom and her movement of it in anticipation of the outcome calls to mind tool-using behaviors in the famously clever primates and corvids, crows and their kin. Moreover, the way she uses the two broom ends differently constitutes the use of a multi-purpose tool, exploiting distinct properties of a single object for different functions. Osuna Mascaro and Ausberg wrote in their paper on the findings, published in Current Biology. Among non-human species, that kind of multi-purpose tool use has been consistently documented only in chimpanzees. Such abilities may be widespread in cattle. "We don't believe that Veronica is the Einstein of cows," Osuna Mascaro says. Together with anecdotal reports of tool use in cattle from South Asia, the results hint that the capacity for complex problem-solving behaviors, including tool use, might have ancient evolutionary roots, but that such behaviors emerge only when conditions are favorable. As a companion animal, Veronica, now 13 years old, has lived a long life in a stimulating environment. Notch im Gailtal is the most idyllic place imaginable for an Austrian cow, like straight out of The Sound of Music, Osuna Mascaro says. He says the family contributed to Veronica's tool use by providing the special conditions that enabled Veronica to express herself. Although she learned to use tools on her own, starting with branches that had fallen from trees, Weigel later furnished her with sticks and rakes that allowed her to perfect her scratching techniques. Most livestock animals, in contrast, live much shorter lives and spend their time in impoverished settings, such as factory farms, without access to objects that they can manipulate. This is fantastic. I applaud the authors as well as Veronica, says primatologist Jill Pruitz of Texas State University, who was not involved in the new research. Pruitz studies how environmental factors influence the behavior of tool-using chimpanzees. She also has two companion cows of her own, Claire and Edith. I am not completely surprised that cattle can use tools. After living in close proximity to my two cows for about 7 years now, I have a lot more respect for bovine intelligence, Pruitz says. What strikes me about Veronica's tool use is the precision with which she can manipulate the tool, as well as switch its ends to target specific areas. The new paper, Pruitz adds, illustrates the need for enrichment for the welfare of cattle. There are around 1.5 billion heads of cattle in the world, and humans have lived with them for at least 10,000 years. It's shocking that we're only discovering this now, Osuna Mascaro says. We know more about the tool use of exotic animals on remote islands than we do about the cows we live with. But we are now starting to be sensitive enough to observe them and give, at least to a few of them, the life they deserve, one in which they have the opportunity to play, interact with objects, and discover how to use them on their own. Kate Wong. Microbiology. Microbes afloat. Spaceflight supercharges viruses' ability to infect bacteria. Bacteria and the viruses that infect them are perpetually at war. Their deadly clashes push both kinds of microbes to evolve new traits that meet the challenges of every environment they inhabit, from the human digestive tract to the seafloor's hydrothermal vents, and even the harsh conditions of space. To see how microgravity changes certain microbes, researchers sent bacteria-infecting viruses, called bacteriophages, to the International Space Station. And they found that the viruses adapted in ways that made them even more effective at infection. In the experiment, detailed in PLOS Biology, the team incubated specimens of common lab bacteriophage T7 alongside its foe, Escherichia coli bacteria, for varying durations. They ran the same experiment on Earth and in space. The terrestrially reared viruses infected bacteria within 2 to 4 hours, but those in space took more than 4 hours to breach bacteria's defenses. The infection took longer in orbit because microgravity is an unfamiliar stressor to which both microbes must adapt, the researchers suggest. Once the viruses adapted to microgravity by subtly shape-shifting, though, they became even more effective bacteria killers. A simple microgravity experiment exposes these mutations that have much higher efficacy against pathogens, says senior study author Srivatsan Raman, a chemical and biological engineer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The difference between Earth and space may have to do with mixing. Under normal gravity, fluid motion continually stirs the environment, increasing the chances that viruses and bacteria will meet, explains Esther Lazaro, an astrobiologist who was not involved in the study. In microgravity, this natural mixing is drastically diminished or disappears altogether. To overcome this lack of mixing, microbes grown in low gravity changed on a genetic level. The bacteriophages gained mutations that slightly changed the shape and structure of their outer membranes, for example, helping them grab onto the bacteria they're attacking. On their return to Earth, the space viruses were placed alongside a different strain of E. coli that's responsible for particularly stubborn urinary tract infections and frequently resistant to bacteriophages. The evolved viruses were able to kill that bacterium, which Rahman says is really quite promising. If exposing these bacteria-targeted viruses to new environmental stressors makes them more potent, scientists might be able to create versions strong enough to help the body fight treatment-resistant bacteria. T7 is one of our iconic model organisms, so there's a lot known about this bacteriophage, says Evelyn Adrianessens, a researcher at the Quadrum Institute in England, who was not involved in the study. It was cool to see that if you go into a different environment, there's still new knowledge that comes up. K.R. Calloway. Biology, lighting the way. The forest may be glowing, at least to deer. At dawn and dusk, forests often appear muted and nearly monochromatic to human eyes. But white-tailed deer might see a very different landscape. To them, the forest could be aglow. Since at least the 1970s, biologists have understood that deer leave scented signposts, spots where they have rubbed their antlers on trees or urinated on scrapes that were carved out of the ground with their hooves. But one group of researchers wondered whether these marks also provide visual messages. The scientists used ultraviolet lights to scan and analyze 146 such signposts in Whitehall Forest in the state of Georgia. They found that although these spots look unremarkable in daytime lighting, they re-emit blue-green light that deer can see when exposed to UV wavelengths, common at dawn and dusk. This glow might happen at antler rubs because the action strips bark away, revealing lignin-rich inner wood that re-emits the longer wavelengths in a way bark does not. If anyone's seen a reflector on a tree, a rub is similar to that, though obviously not as stark, says study lead author Daniel DeRose Brokert, a biologist at the University of Georgia. The visual contrast also intensifies as the breeding season approaches. In their paper describing the findings, published in Ecology and Evolution, the authors found that rubs made later in the season produce stronger photoluminescent signals, a pattern that coincides with rising testosterone levels and associated marking activity. Rubbing can both strip away bark to reveal fluorescent inner wood and deposit glandular secretions, either of which may contribute to the signal. This shift in light is particularly relevant, the authors say, because the eyes of white-tailed deer have enhanced sensitivity to short and middle wavelength colors, which are common under low-light conditions. Traditionally, mammalian biofluorescence, such as the glowing fur of bare-nosed wombats and bandicoots, has been studied as a property of the animal itself. Biological material, such as semen, is also known to fluoresce under UV light. This work suggests that biofluorescence might be embedded in the environment as well, even if only subtly, contributing a largely unseen layer to how animals might be communicating. Not everyone is convinced that these fluorescent contrasts would be visible to deer under natural conditions, however. If humans do not see these markings under natural light, then deer are unlikely to see them, says Almut Kelber, a sensory biologist at Lund University in Sweden, who was not part of the study. Demonstrating a visual role would require behavioral tests that separate sight from smell, she adds. DeRose Brockert describes the study as a first step. It documents that rubs and scrapes can generate contrast at wavelengths deer can see, and lays the groundwork for future experiments with natural lighting. Anirman Mukhopadhyay. Robotics. Catching fear. Fuzzy, fast-breathing robots can make humans more afraid. We've all instinctively clung to another person when frightened, if only as a child clutching our mother's hand. But if that person is scared too, this behavior may not have the desired calming effect. And a new study, published in the journal Emotion, suggests that a robot that mimics human breathing can also pass on frightened feelings. The researchers developed round, fluffy robots with motorized rib cages that can simulate breathing by expanding and contracting. More than 100 participants held these robots, which breathed in a stable pattern, in an accelerated, fearful manner, or not at all, while the participants watched a scary clip from The Shining. The team found that the heart rates of people holding hyperventilating robots increased the most, compared with those holding chilled-out or stationary robots. Participants reported that they perceived the robots as afraid, supporting the idea that they had caught the robot's emotional state. It's the first study to show we can exacerbate emotion experiences using breathing robots, says psychologist Zachary Witkower of the University of Amsterdam, who led the study. It has implications for understanding human-robot interaction. Interaction between humans and robots is usually studied through visual and spoken exchanges. The touch aspect is novel and interesting, says Eric Vanman, a psychologist at the University of Queensland in Australia, who studies human interaction with emerging technologies. It's probably going to cause other researchers to look at the information we get from touch. Additionally, participants holding steady breathing robots showed slower heart rates. This difference wasn't significant, but it suggests that contact with a steady breather might calm one's emotions. Previous research supports this. There's evidence that touching animals and humans can have calming effects, Vanman says. If so, researchers could develop therapeutic devices that help us attain desired emotional states. We've already started discussions with clinical psychologists, Witkower says. We're focused on developing dynamic robots for regulating anxiety. The work could also inspire wearable devices that safely boost thrilling experiences, such as video games and horror films, Vanman adds. Vanman would like to see future studies measure respiration to check whether the heart rate change is linked to people matching the robot's breathing patterns, as well as other indicators. Witkower and his colleagues plan to track additional markers in future studies, and they hope to examine whether breathing robots could sense and react to human physiology automatically. Simon Makin. Animal cognition. Mindless sleep. Even without brains, sea anemones and jellyfish can sleep like humans do. Jellyfish and sea anemones are curious creatures. These organisms evolved without a brain, and, as scientists discovered in the past several years, don't need one to sleep. The animals do, however, have neurons, nerve cells that appear interconnected throughout their body. A new study shows that how these animals sleep is surprisingly similar to the way humans do. suggesting that human-like sleep might have evolved before even the most primitive brains. The findings, published in Nature Communications, also shed light on one of science's prevailing mysteries. Why do animals sleep? They add to past evidence from other animals and humans that sleep provides a window of downtime for maintenance on the brain and body, helping to repair DNA damage and maintain neuronal health. This confirms that sleep allows a window for key housekeeping tasks, says Philippe Morain, an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University, who studies sleep and was not involved in the new study. The work shows this function of sleep has been conserved across evolution, Morain says. From animals with some of the most complex brains, such as primates, to animals that have none, such as jellyfish and other cnidarians. The researchers studied one jellyfish and one sea anemone species, finding that the jellyfish appears to enter a sleep-like state for around 8 hours a day, and generally at night, a schedule many humans might recognize. The sea anemone analyzed also appears to shut down for around a third of the day. The study animals slept more when the researchers damaged their neurons, a finding that Morain says gives clues to what makes us fall asleep in the first place. By Claire Cameron. Forensic science. Crime bugs. Machine learning models speed up forensic analysis of crucial crime scene larvae. A mass of writhing maggots on a decomposing murder victim is not a sight for the squeamish, but for some, it is evidence. A maggot's age and species can give essential information to forensic entomologists investigating murders. A single wriggling horsefly maggot, for instance, found on a dead body far from water, gave entomologists in 2022 a key lead to where the body came from. Combing through these fly larvae, investigators can potentially learn when and where a crime happened, whether the body has been moved or whether toxins were involved. For example, blowflies are among the earliest insect colonizers of corpses. They typically sniff out and lay eggs on a dead body within minutes to hours. How fast the maggots, also called larvae, develop depends on heat, humidity, and the insect's species and sex. To use this evidence, investigators typically must grow the larvae until adulthood in a laboratory setting, and then identify them, either visually or by genetic sequence. But what if the larvae are dead or missing? There's no high-quality DNA, or there isn't the time or equipment to sequence the fly's genomes. People in a crime lab simply do not have the resident expertise or the resources to be able to routinely conduct DNA analysis on insect evidence, says Rabi Musa, a bioorganic chemist at Louisiana State University. To tackle these challenges, Musa and other researchers have combined machine learning algorithms with methods such as infrared spectroscopy and chemical profiling to quickly pinpoint maggots' species and sex. Such tools could help experts rapidly identify the maggots without the larvae's DNA or without the larvae altogether, only what they leave behind, saving time and money usually spent in sequencing. They could also help investigators take measurements at the scene of the crime itself to determine larval sex. Musa measured the chemical profiles, called the metabolome of insect eggs, larvae, and pupae, using a type of mass spectrometry, a technique that can tease apart molecules called metabolites based on their mass and charge. With these data, she and her team are building a large metabolome database for most of the insects that colonize decomposing remains. her team's machine learning algorithm trained on the data would let investigators using a mass spectrometer, which is less expensive and much easier to use than a DNA sequencer, reliably match a new chemical profile to an insect species in less than 5 minutes. A similar approach can work even without the larvae themselves. Sometimes people come across fully decomposed bodies many months or years after a murder. By that time, the larvae are long gone, Musa says. And the only remaining insect evidence is the hard shell-like exteriors of the pupae, tools of the metamorphosis discarded after the larvae become adult flies. It's impossible to identify pupae coverings with the naked eye, and in many cases, the DNA contained within them is too old and degraded for sequencing. But as Musa's group reported in a recent paper in Forensic Chemistry, their method of chemical fingerprinting followed by machine-assisted classification works with casings too. Finding the chemical profile of casings can even reveal toxins in the victims' bodies, because the larvae tend to store them in their pupal coverings. The rate of molecular breakdown might also someday point to the casing's ages. Other groups are also trying to use machine learning to catalog crime scenes' larval visitors. For instance, a team of Texas A&M researchers recently developed a method that combines infrared measurements from a handheld device with machine learning to identify blowfly larvae's sexes. Male and female larvae develop at different speeds and can help investigators pinpoint when they first colonized remains, but their sexes are indistinguishable by eye. To identify sexes, investigators can crush the larvae and amplify their DNA using PCR, which is time-consuming, renders the larvae useless for any further studies, and has only an 80% chance of working correctly. Aiden Holman, a Texas A&M toxicology graduate student, and his colleagues set out to find larvae's sexes without having to mash them up. After first rearing the male and female larvae separately, Holman's group used a handheld infrared spectroscopy device to zap them and measure the light released. The proteins, fats, and other molecules that make up the larvae scatter the light in unique ways, generating a specific spectral signature based on sex. The researchers then trained a machine learning model on this spectral data and found that it could predict the larvae's sex with more than 90% accuracy. Next, they will collect data from a much bigger selection of flies to train their model. Murdoch University forensic entomologist Paola Magni, who is not involved in either project, emphasizes that these machine learning databases will need to be officially vetted, as DNA sequence banks are, so results aren't later overturned legally. And use of AI more broadly in this process can be risky, she adds. The flip of the coin of artificial intelligence can become very dangerous in a forensic context, because you can really cause a miscarriage of justice, she says. Plus, she and Musa both highlight that more research is needed into how other substances in the body might skew molecular markers. And Musa is pulling data from across as large and global an insect sample as possible to find the markers that remain constant. The enhancement and expansion of the database involves a never-ending process, Musa says. Texas A&M forensic entomologist Jeff Tomberlin, who was also not involved in either project, believes that cutting-edge methods like machine learning should be integrated into forensic casework. But, he notes, their long-term accuracy, precision, and potential biases need to be carefully studied as well. We're in the infancy of applying these methods in this particular realm, he says. So if you think of it like an arc, we're at the beginning of the arc. By Rohini Subramayam. Medicine. Automatic breathing. Artificial lungs kept a patient alive for 2 days before transplant. In 2023, thoracic surgeon Ankit Bharat was working at Northwestern Memorial Hospital when he was drafted to help a 33-year-old influenza patient who was on the verge of death. Bharat recalls that the man had developed a secondary infection from one of the most dreaded bugs in the hospital, Pseudomonas, and had been put on a ventilator. The patient's lungs were filling with fluid and pus. His kidneys were failing, and his heart was barely working, Bharat says. He was actively dying. Then the patient's heart stopped. We got him back, but it was very clear we had to do something right away, Bharat says. The man needed a double lung transplant, but there was a problem. He was too sick for Bharat and his colleagues to attempt the operation. But Bharat knew that without a working set of lungs, the patient would die regardless. He had already been on a life support system called extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, ECMO, to oxygenate his blood. But that treatment can't sustain a patient without lungs in their body, Bharat says. So Bharat and his team worked up a plan. They would build artificial lungs that could help pump blood from the right side of the patient's heart to the left side, oxygenate it, and send it on to the rest of the body. Bharat likens the novel system to adding a bridge to a highway. Like interstate traffic, blood travels from the right side of the heart to the lungs, then to the left side of the heart, and then throughout the body. With no lungs, the highway hits a dead end. Bharat's artificial lungs literally bridged the gap, moving and oxygenating blood in place of the patient's lungs, which were removed. And to prevent a traffic jam on that bridge, Bharat's team also built an exit road for blood to return to the right side of the heart. The system kept the patient alive for 2 days, effectively lungless, letting him begin to recover from the infection. It was almost like a curse or something that just got lifted, Bharat says, and suddenly everything started to heal. The patient was placed on the lung transplant candidate list, and just hours later he had a donor. The team completed the transplant, and after some extra weeks of recovering in the hospital, the man was discharged, weak but alive. Now, more than 2 years later, he's doing great, by the way, Bharat says. Systems similar to Bharat's artificial lungs have been described by doctors before, says Matthew Hartwig, a professor of surgery at Duke University, who was not involved with the patient's care. But Bharat's method, he says, offers a novel approach to the same problem that everyone is facing in the field. The process is described in a paper published in the journal Med. Bharat hopes his lung system can be used at other hospitals as a nuclear option to save patients who are critically ill. We have described all the lessons that we've learned in that paper, how we came up with every single configuration, what is the rationale behind it, and anybody can replicate that, he says. There is nothing proprietary about this. He hopes it could ultimately mean that there will be more success stories like that of the patient he helped save in 2023. Even at the end of the day, if we save one extra life, we'll be happy with that, Bharat says. By Jackie Flynn Mogensen. Animal communication. Making faces. Primate facial expressions may not be solely reflexive. Facial expressions are central to social life, yet scientists still don't fully understand how the brain produces them. For decades, one influential theory has held that what appears on a person's face is largely an emotional reflex, an honest, automatic readout of what they feel inside. But that view doesn't explain the fact that we often tailor our countenance to the moment. We've all smiled politely through a dull date, or tried not to smile while holding a royal flush. To find out what's going on in the brain as facial expressions arise, researchers turned to rhesus macaques, old world monkeys with face musculature and neuroanatomy that are similar to that of humans. They recorded neural activity in the laboratory while the animals interacted with one another, with human experimenters, with digital avatars, and with video of other macaques. The team's results, published recently in Science, came as a surprise. The monkeys' expressions, from a tooth-bearing threatening face to a friendly lip-smacking one, were generated by both the medial cortex and the lateral cortex. These two parts of the brain's frontal lobe were long thought to operate independently, the medial cortex dealing with spontaneous emotional expressions, and the lateral cortex controlling voluntary actions. Our study did not show that at all, says co-lead author Gina Iani, a neurology resident at the University of Pennsylvania. It showed that all regions participated in the production of all kinds of facial expressions. The two regions did, however, run at different speeds. The way they encode information has a distinct tempo, says co-lead author Yuriria Vasquez, a neuroscientist at the Rockefeller University. Activity in the lateral cortex shifted quickly, over milliseconds, to coordinate the rapid facial movements that make for smooth social interaction. In contrast, things happened at a more leisurely pace in the medial cortex, perhaps allowing it to track slow-changing contextual factors, such as, has the alpha male stopped threatening me? That influence facial expressions. What's more, both neural patterns showed up before facial movements did, suggesting the brain prepares expressions in advance. This all raises a question. Do macaques intentionally plan the faces they make? That's the interpretation that Bridget Waller and Jamie Whitehouse, evolutionary psychologists at Nottingham Trent University in England, explore in a commentary on the study. If facial expressions are partly voluntary, they may be less like emotional mirrors and more like tools for social influence, as Waller and Whitehouse put it. At the very least, they seem to result from complex interactions between emotion and cognition. Alan Fridland, a social and evolutionary psychologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who was not involved in this study, has no trouble believing macaques wield their faces strategically. But he doubts that staged, lab-bound interactions can capture the full reality of primate communications or the neural activity underlying them. Ideally, future research would take place in the monkey's natural environment. Still, Fridland says, the exploration tells us in infinitely more detail how we can investigate the neurology of facial displays. By Cody Codier. Neuroscience, lost in the music. Rhythmic tunes trigger synchronized eye blinks and directional movement. Music makes people move and groove, often in surprisingly involuntary ways. As it turns out, we even blink in time to the beat. Researchers report in PLOS Biology. Our eyes, which we usually think of as purely visual organs, spontaneously dance to the rhythm of what we hear, says study co-author Du Yi, a cognitive neuroscientist at the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing. Additional research showed certain songs cause a tendency toward either bop or sway movements. Using a high-speed eye-tracking system, Du and her team were stunned to discover non-musicians instinctively blinking in sync with the beat structure of Bach chorales, though not on every single beat, she notes, which would be quite exhausting. Du suspects the effect would persist for any music with a strong groove, not just Bach. Synchronized blinking faded when the researchers sped up the Bach chorales to 120 beats per minute. It also disappeared when the study's participants were asked to detect a red dot on a screen, implying that active listening is required. It isn't that the music loses its magic when we're distracted, but rather that the brain reallocates its rhythmic resources to whatever we are focusing on most, Dew says. Blinking to the Beat came as no surprise to Elizabeth Margulis, director of Princeton University's Music Cognition Lab, and author of an upcoming book on musical daydreams. After all, she notes, music activates the motor areas of the brain. Even if we're just sitting still and not bopping our heads, tapping our feet, or dancing, there can often be this sense of motion, Margulis says. People tend to synchronize their steps to the beat at the gym and drive faster when listening to pulsing, absorbing songs, she notes. Those with Parkinson's disease, meanwhile, are known to walk more steadily when music is playing. Even voluntary music response seems to have an instinctual aspect. Shimpei Ikigami, a music psychologist at Showa Women's University in Tokyo, asked four Japanese pop musicians to compose short musical excerpts, some designed to elicit vertical up-and-down bopping movements, known as tate nori, and others designed to elicit horizontal side-to-side swaying movements, called yoko nori. Sure enough, when undergraduate non-musicians listened to songs with a strong beat and abrupt changes in sound, they spontaneously felt like bopping. And songs characterized by a smooth timbre and mild sound changes made them want to sway. To Ikigami, who presented his findings at a recent conference, this suggests that the music instructs us on how to move, and that runners and Parkinson's patients, for example, might get better results with vertical music, whereas horizontal music lends itself to stretching and yoga. In general, he says, our playlists could be much more targeted to take advantage of powerful innate reactions to pumping up the volume. By Jesse Greenspan. Paleontology, Mystery Towers. Bizarre proto-taxites fossils may come from a newly discovered kind of life. Before trees came along, some 400 million years ago, our planet's landscape was dominated by enigmatic, spire-shaped life forms that towered more than 25 feet above the ground. Fragments of these trunk-like organisms were discovered among fossils collected in 1843. Yet despite more than a century of speculation, scientists have struggled to answer the most basic question about Earth's original terrestrial giants. What were they? According to a recent study, that may be because they belonged to a previously unknown branch of life. The first person to examine this biological misfit did so in 1856, and in 1859 he dubbed it proto-taxites, which means early yew. The name stuck, even though experts soon realized the organism wasn't a tree at all. Maybe it was some kind of land-based kelp, or a megalithic mushroom. It seems like it doesn't fit comfortably anywhere, says Matthew Nelson, a senior research scientist at the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago, who was not involved in the new study. People have tried to shoehorn it into these different groups, but there are always things that don't make sense. Over time, two main hypotheses emerged. Either proto-taxites were an ancient fungus, or it fell into a category all on its own. Now, after comparing fossils from these cryptic organisms with fossil fungi from the same rock deposit, the authors of the new study, published in Science Advances, conclude the proto-taxites were probably a distinct lineage. That would place it on equal footing with the other recognized kingdoms of life, those of plants, animals, fungi, protists, bacteria, and archaea. Proto-taxites were composed of interwoven tubes, giving it a superficial resemblance to fungi, but the anatomical similarities end there. The researchers found that the tubes inside proto-taxites branched wildly. whereas the thread-like hyphae in modern fungi follow more orderly patterns. Plus, the researchers detected no chemical trace of chitin, a polymer found in the cell walls of all living fungi and in the fossil fungi that were preserved alongside prototaxites. It doesn't seem to have any of the characteristic features of the living fungal groups, says the study's co-lead author Laura Cooper, a PhD student at the University of Edinburgh. This finding wasn't totally unforeseen. In a 2022 paper, Nelson and his co-author, paleobotanist Kevin Boyce of Stanford University, argued that if prototaxites were indeed of fungal origin, it may represent part of an extinct lineage. In other words, it already stood apart from other fungi. Boyce is agnostic about where prototaxites truly belong. And he isn't prepared to cast it out of the fungal kingdom yet. But he notes that even if the organism is merely an oddball fungus, it independently evolved a unique form of complex multicellular life. No matter what, Boyce says, it's something weird doing its own thing. Cooper argues prototaxites was so fundamentally different from the fungi we see today that trying to shove it in with the fungi is not productive. Even if this study settled the question of taxonomy, there would be much left to learn. Previous work by Boyce suggests that prototaxites might have played an ecological role much like that of fungi, consuming decayed organic matter. Little organic matter was available in its time, yet in a world of knee-high plants, these organisms grew as tall as telephone poles. How that actually works energetically, Cooper says, is still a complete mystery. By Cody Codier. Education, adding it up. Arithmetic shortcuts predict future STEM performance. What is 29 plus 14? Some readers may solve the problem procedurally. Line up the two numbers, add the ones column, carry the one, and add the tens to get 43. Others might instead notice a creative shortcut. 29 plus 14 is the same as 30 plus 13, a much easier sum to calculate. Recent studies show that the less likely someone is to use procedural solutions, the better they tend to be at more abstract problem solving, and gender is a significant predictor. In a new study, researchers asked a group of 213 students from one Midwestern U.S. high school to do three arithmetic problems. Only 18% of the boys used the procedural method for all three questions, compared with 52% of the girls. And those who rarely used a procedural algorithm were significantly more likely to succeed on problem-solving questions. Honestly, the results blew me away, says Indiana University Bloomington mathematics education researcher Sarah Lubienski, a co-author of the study, published in the British Journal of Educational Psychology. They are the most interesting findings of my career, she adds. And that was before Lubienski and one of her co-authors realized that another group had reached almost identical conclusions in a similar study with 810 U.S. adults. The researchers decided to team up for a two-study paper. Together, we felt like it made a pretty compelling argument that we need to pay more attention to how people are approaching computation from a young age, Lubienski says. The team found that students who reported a greater desire to please their teachers, a trait that skews heavily female, were more likely to solve problems procedurally. That is, the way the teacher instructed them to. This tendency could factor into a long-standing paradox in math education. Girls often have better math grades than boys, and girls and boys perform similarly on state assessments. But girls lag behind on high-stakes testing, such as the SAT and beyond, especially with tasks that involve solving problems they've never seen before. The same studiousness that helps girls get ahead in school may be holding them back later on. The researchers also found that creative problem-solving was correlated with stronger spatial skills, specifically with being able to rotate objects in one's mind, an ability that Lubienski says can be learned. What I find exciting is that the paper points to potentially malleable mechanisms, not just girls do X, boys do Y, but why those differences might emerge, says education researcher Joseph Simpian of New York University, who was not involved in either study. The issue may be not ability, but rather the interaction of instruction, classroom norms, anxiety, and what students believe is expected of them. Even if you're no longer in high school, it's never too late to improve your problem-solving skills and practice thinking outside the box, Lubienski says. Try to solve math problems, puzzles, and Scientific American, she suggests. By Emma R. Hassan. Math Puzzle, Tricky Calculation, by Emma R. Hassan. Using only the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6, and the mathematical operations addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division, can you arrive at the value 456? You may use each number at most once in your full solution, and parentheses are permitted. For the solution, visit www.scientificamerican.com/games/math-puzzles. Science Times, The New York Times, Tuesday, April 7, 2026. Measuring snow from space. Scientists climb a mountain to monitor a new satellite for a global study on precipitation, by Sachi Kitajima Mulki. At 4:30 a.m. on a recent Wednesday, three alpine scientists arose from fitful sleep in a chilly research lab in the Colorado Rockies, 11,500 feet above sea level. They drank some grainy coffee, strapped into their skis, and headed out into the moonlight, dragging a sled loaded with gear. They had a satellite to meet. The scientists were on an unusual mission. They needed to measure the depth of the snow at a particular mountaintop location, just as a new satellite passed directly overhead. That satellite, equipped with powerful radar, has the potential to be the first one capable of estimating how much water is on the ground, in the form of fallen snow, from outer space. It would be an extraordinary technological milestone, providing global data on snowpack, precipitation, and how much water might be available to feed rivers and reservoirs downstream in spring and summer. But first, the satellite would need to be calibrated. One of the most accurate ways to do it is to be physically present on the mountain to measure the snow under the exact same conditions and at the exact same time that the satellite does. Other scientists are doing similar things around the world. Precise timing matters. Snow changes quickly, and the satellite passes over the same spot only once every 12 days. So with hearts pounding from the thin alpine air, the three skied out onto moonlit snow. Two of them towed the sled equipped with a small portable radar capable of measuring the snow's depth and density simply by dragging it back and forth across the mountainside. Only 4 centimeters deep here, one of the scientists, Emma Tyrell, called out. She was leading the project as part of her PhD at the University of Colorado and the Institute of Arctic and Alpine Research. At the back of the sled was Ariel Koshkin, a postdoctoral researcher in the same lab, who made a note of the measurement. For 2 hours, Ms. Tyrell and Dr. Koshkin skied back and forth in precise zigzags across the slope of the ridgeline, pulling the radar with them and plunging a ruler into the snow every few feet. Somewhere invisibly above them, the satellite charted its own path across the sky. The satellite, known as NISAR, was launched last summer by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the Indian Space Research Organization. The satellite's capabilities are the closest that humans have come to measuring water content in snow across vast regions, from space, the holy grail of snow science. The new technology comes at a critical time. As the world warms, snow is vanishing across many parts of the planet. That includes the western United States, which is currently undergoing a record snow drought. In states including Colorado and Utah, the snowpack is the lowest since comprehensive modern recording began 40 years ago. That's a problem because these states rely on snowmelt for up to 80% of their water. Snowpack, Ms. Tyrell said, acts like a frozen water tower, storing and releasing water that then gets used by communities and farms downstream throughout the year. She paused to gesture across the mountain peaks where the snow was visibly patchy and thin. The area she was working, known as Niwot Ridge, would typically be blanketed in a thick layer of snow this time of year. The area is part of a watershed that provides a third of the water needed by the city of Boulder, which was visible that morning some 25 miles away as a cluster of twinkling lights. The warming world will doubtlessly transform Colorado, but because of the state's high elevation, there's uncertainty about precisely how that might play out, Dr. Koshkin said, speaking as she helped Miss Tyrell adjust a GPS sensor on the top of the sled. Some precipitation might fall as rain instead of snow, but rain doesn't remain stored on the mountainside to steadily provide meltwater later in the year. She also said the swings between good and bad snow years are likely to become more drastic. The sun had started to rise, tinting the mountains scarlet. Several dozen yards away, Millie Spencer, a PhD candidate in the same research group, helping out on the day's mission, was digging a snow pit with a shovel. This old-school approach remains the gold standard for accurate data on snow. Even when working with modern technologies like the sled radar, scientists often take analog measurements from snow pits at the same time. Okay, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you.